Make no friendship with an angry man, lest you learn his ways and your soul gets ensnared. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. This is The Spirit of Things. Welcome to Anger, the third in our Seven Deadly Sins series, here on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. That biblical proverb says anger is learned, and it's easy to get trapped in its ways. So what frees you from anger? We'll hear from Mandy, who tells us about her life of anger, addiction, and prison, and how she broke free of it all. Don't miss Mandy's story later in the program. For everyday frustrations, is avoidance of anger the best thing? Or is it important to get it off your chest? In the 1976 movie Network, a failing news announcer who's about to get the sack has a nervous breakdown on air and gets very angry at everything. Soon he galvanizes the nation with his rant, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." This is his basic message to America.
I want you to get mad.
I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressmen because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
To discuss anger, philosopher and ethicist Simon Blackburn of Cambridge University joins with forensic psychiatrist at the Medical School of the University of Wollongong, Robert Kaplan, and Buddhist nun involved in the Liberation Prison Project, Robina Corton. Robina Corton, Simon Blackburn, Robert Kaplan, welcome to this conversation about anger, which I think is one of the most difficult of emotions to categorize, perhaps because we are often so defensive about it. I know I am. Simon, is there a good philosophical definition of anger?
I don't know that there's a definition. There's certainly lots of descriptions of the emotion. And of course, we all know some of the descriptions. We know what happens when we get angry. And, of course, there's a lot of moralizing about it. There's philosophers who try to suppress it, like the Stoics. Sensible people, like Aristotle, who say you need a mean. And there are people who've discussed why we feel it at all, what its adaptive advantage is, what it does for us as social animals. So I think there's been quite a lot of discussion. I'm not sure a definition has come up.
Well, certainly the Stoics, represented by Seneca, were very suspicious of it. I think he said there was nothing good about anger.
Yes, well, the Stoic motto in general is do not disturb. They didn't like the emotions in general. They thought that the good life consisted in suppressing them as much as possible. But anger, of course, they saw the bad effects of anger. I think in the Roman Empire it was probably rather a prominent feature of emperors' lives, for example. His view was that you became angry because you had high expectations. You expected too much of life, and then life let you down, and then you got angry because either the gods or the fates, or more likely other people, had screwed up, and you know your rights had been trespassed against, and then you fly off the handle. And so the cure for Seneca was just not to expect so much. Don't expect too much of other people. Don't expect too much of life. Don't expect the traffic all to part miraculously in front of you. And you won't get angry when it doesn't.
Well, it can be a very ordinary life. But Robina, does Seneca's view of anger resonate with the Buddhist point of view?
Yes, I was listening with delight, you know. I haven't read many of these Greeks, but I think they were contemporaries with the Buddha, weren't they?
Pretty much. Well, Seneca's a bit later. But
okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems very familiar. You know, in fact, there is a definition. This is a kind of a paraphrasing of it. It's a very nice one. But as one Tibetan said, that anger is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants.
Oh, yes. Right.
Which is really very much this business of these over-exaggerated expectations and then upset when it doesn't arise, you know. Mm-hmm. Very much the Buddhist approach is a philosophical one. You know, Buddha, as you know, is not a creator. It's a natural law. And then it's psychology. So looking into the mind and seeing all the need in this way and the traffic depart and the light not to be read. So naturally the response is, it's eye-based, you know, so it can be, in that sense, it's a neurotic thing.
Is anger then always a sign of delusion to the Buddhist?
There's no way you could say, from the Buddhist point of view, speaking loudly is wrong, is delusional. Even telling someone off is delusional. It's the key is where you're coming from. Is it the wish to harm someone? But if it's like tough love of a mother, no more chocolate, go to your room. If she's being an authentic mother, you can't say that's anger. That looks like anger, but she's coming from kindness. So the key to define it is, the key to see it is the motivation. But on the surface, you can see it pretty quickly.
Well, Robert, as a psychiatrist, do you agree with Freud that beneath the veneer of culture, we're all just a seething sea of anger and emotion and the id?
Well, I agree with Freud on some things, but not necessarily on that. I see anger as one, from a neuroscience point of view, as one of the four basic emotions. We've all got them. It's a question of how much of it we've got and what we do with it. And this goes back all the way in evolution to the way our brains are built.
Well, considering that anger or wrath is one of the seven deadly sins, how about pathological anger? Is there a definition for pathological anger from the psychiatric point of view?
The way it's seen psychiatrically is anger is the emotion, and what they call the epiphenomenon is, you can call it pathological anger or violence or rage. So those are the terms they use. In other words, the behavior that results from the emotion.
How much of pathological anger do you think stems from nature versus nurture?
Oh, I think an enormous amount stems from nature, but I wouldn't underestimate the formative influences around us. It's a bit like what I call the lock and key effect. If you look at the most extreme examples, I'll just use this example of the hideous serial killer. Almost invariably, they're born that way, but unless they have certain formative experiences, it's not going to come out.
Well, you just published a book on some serial killers, but they're rather an unusual category. They're actually doctors. And one of the case studies was Harold Shipman, the famous British doctor who killed hundreds of women, mainly women. Do you think he was driven by a kind of pathological anger?
There certainly was that element in Shipman, because he otherwise came from what appeared to be quite a normal family background, but the death of his mother in front of him when he was 17 from cancer seemed to trigger something. I should point out that Shipman didn't specialize in killing women. It is just that he had access mostly to elderly women as his patients, and he found they were the easiest. He killed men, and he killed quite young people when he could. But if you look at serial killers in general, and particularly my favorite one, Jack the Ripper, you always see the same pattern, this intense ambivalence towards their mother, who's the ultimate love-hate figure. They never seem to feel that way towards their fathers in the slightest.
Well, he certainly, Jack the Ripper or Harold Shipman or all of the others, they didn't seem to suffer from guilt. Is it in fact the intellectual rationalizations and the role they play in, for example, doctors who murder patients? Are the rationalizations the real problem?
I don't think so. We're talking about people who are at an extreme. If you look at, you go from antisocial personalities who commit crimes to psychopaths to a very small group who become serial killers, and they are simply born devoid of any moral sensibility as we understand it. So they have no capacity for guilt.
An action that is violent, that has no sense of conscience around it, would that come into the category of sin?
It depends how you look at it, and I'd be very interested to hear what Simon says, because the old term for a psychopath was somebody who was morally insane. In other words, all the restraints we have that govern our actions were gone. And I actually feel that in an odd ethical way, should we be punishing psychopaths for something they're incapable of anyway? We may have to protect society, but that's a different thing. And I wondered what Simon would like to say.
Well, I think the case of the psychopath who feels no moral emotions is, of course, very extreme. Most of us have empathy with other people. And, of course, as social animals, most of us are very quick to notice, for example, when our behavior is upsetting somebody else, and then to withdraw, or if it's really upset them, and perhaps if it's really upset them accidentally, then we feel guilty. And I think guilt is quite interestingly related to anger. Guilt is a kind of coordinative emotion. With guilt, you're primed to expect or accept the anger of others. It's a sense that you've done something for which the pack might be apt to turn upon you. And if you were a member of the pack, you'd turn upon somebody else who'd done what you'd just done. So I think guilt I see as a coordinating response. It coordinates us to expect the anger of others, and that can defuse the situation. It can stop the cycle of revenge. So I see guilt as a, you know, as an essential part of a normal life, as a social animal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it can be overdone. So can anger. So can everything.
Yes, one of the responses that some people regard as sort of overdone is perhaps Jesus' teaching to love one's enemies.
Yeah.
But won't good men always be angry with bad men?
Well, Jesus was. I mean, he flailed about in the temple and chucked out the moneylenders, and I believe the story has him getting pretty angry at them. I think that indignation, righteous indignation, is, as it were, the good side of anger. If we're not angry at injustice or angry at, you know, serious social imbalances and problems, but let's say injustice, then, of course, we're not motivated to do much about it.
But righteous indignation can then result in war.
Yes.
Now, from a philosophical point of view, I suppose war is probably the extreme expression of anger.
Yeah.
But is it acceptable?
Oh, no, I think not. I think war is always failure. War is like violence in the street. That's happened when social negotiations, social relations have broken down, and only thing is to destroy the other. That's the ultimate resort, and it's always a sign of failure.
But can't it also be defensive, for example, to protect your children?
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, whether one then becomes a pacifist as a matter of principle or not is, I think, a difficult thing, because you will want to protect your children. I think what we've got to learn to do is accept our humanity, which will include an emotional component. But, of course, these emotions can all get out of hand. They all get overdone. That's when the Aristotelian doctrine of the mean comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to feel the right things to the right extent on the right occasions. And that's always an exercise of culture and judgment.
Yes, a long and deliberative process.
Mm.
Robina, does Buddhism have a concept of righteous indignation?
I think the key to all of this is that it's, again, this business of where you're coming from, what your motivation is. And this is where introspection has to come. And I'm hearing Simon talk, and it seems to be the way that the Greeks are talking. You have to have some sense of it, have the ability to look into your own mind. You know, it's not just an external or a theoretical thing. So if I look into my own mind and I begin to identify my own neediness, whether when I was an old radical lefty, you know, shouting and yelling in the streets of London and, you know, getting angry, I can see very clearly there was altruism there, but there was also a huge impatience with what Robina didn't want. And I think this compassion and the anger mixed together into what's called righteous, but I can see that very often it wasn't. It was just my own fury, you know, overtaking, and in the end it wasn't very intelligent, and in the end too, I mostly didn't get what I wanted.
But for example, in Tibet, when last year there were protests against the Chinese regime, we saw Buddhists out on the streets, including Buddhist monks.
That's right. The main ones have been the Buddhist monks and nuns.
Now, they were attached to a particular view, which was that what the Chinese were doing was wrong. Were they wrong?
Assume someone's attached to something when we see behavior. So I'll use one example. I'm not trying to say they're all holy, but I have a friend of mine, a monk, who demonstrated in 87 in the first sort of mini uprising since 59. He was then arrested, tortured, then escaped and came to Nepal. Since that time, his father was murdered, brother was murdered, and they were on hit lists and things. And he'd been demonstrating. And I said, "Do you ever get angry?" And he laughed. He said, "Angry? What for?" So I could deduce that he was, and I know the man, that he wasn't angry in that sense of being uncontrolled, but that he expressed what you could call righteous indignation. So what I'm saying is, of course it's possible. Mm-hmm. It is possible, like the good mother, to look like she's angry, but in her heart, absolutely not. She has the well-being of the people in front of her.
A lot of parents know just what she means. The Venerable Robina Korten. You might have seen the documentary film about her, Chasing Buddha. Robert Kaplan is a forensic psychiatrist and author of Medical Murder, Disturbing Cases of Doctors Who Kill. And Simon Blackburn teaches philosophy at Cambridge University and has written numerous books, including Being Good, An Introduction to Ethics. You're tuned to ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. Now, back to anger and its ancient expressions. Well, Robert, there was one group of people who were known to the world for their righteous indignation, and that is the Hebrew prophets. And Ezekiel was certainly one of the most extreme, and I know that he interests you. Have you psychoanalyzed Ezekiel, the prophet?
No, but then I'm not a psychoanalyst, but I have read him and I've read a lot of work about him, and he's a source of considerable interest. But you're right. I think one of the things about being a prophet is your more extreme emotions, and of course anger is one of them. I've never seen a description of a nice laid-back prophet. It just doesn't go with the territory.
What is it about Ezekiel, though, that particularly interests you?
Well, it's this interesting combination. Firstly, it's widely regarded as the best written book in the Bible. And the general belief now is that it is by one author, not redacted from a whole lot of people. So that's interesting. Secondly, the sheer extreme nature of what he's saying. He's saying to the Jewish people, you lost your temple because you didn't worship, you weren't righteous enough. He's also saying, look, these Babylonians have done these awful things to us. So he sets up the whore of Egypt and the whore of Israel, and then he proceeds to serial kill them. He cuts their ears and their nose off. He slays them brutally. It's the most extraordinary, extreme misogyny. And then, of course, there's the famous hallucination and all the stuff that goes with it.
Is that kind of literature a way of ritualizing anger?
Well, I think the way I conceive of it, if you look at the most extreme kind of people doing this sort of thing, and this is my theory, is that Ezekiel had temporal lobe epilepsy. And these people have this famous epileptic personality characterized by this intense anger, hypergraphia, religiosity, and absolute intolerance. And they just pour out the stuff, and you can see it in Ezekiel. Now, that's the right and the extreme. So clearly there's a spectrum heading towards it. And I think that's what a lot of these prophet types have. And they're not just biblical. You have to look at Savonarola, who got his just deserts of the stake, and even Calvin, who I find quite an interesting character nowadays. His absolute remorselessness in punishing what he saw as sin and wiping it out like that.
And I think we probably see it today. I mean, it's not entirely foreign, I think, to the world of the boardroom, the world of politics. You know, if you can become angry at something and get other people to feel the same emotion, then you're en route to being a leader, and you've got a cause, you've got something that you can motivate yourself to throw your back into. And of course, it may be all for the good and maybe all for the bad.
So politics as a ritualized form of anger.
Well, I think that, you know, you only have to look at Prime Minister's Question Time in Britain to see, yes, I mean, you know, the Conservatives will get up and say, I've never seen anything as bad as this government. And then the government says, well, yes, but if you lot were in power, it would be awful. And they all shake their fists at each other. And I think it goes on in Australia, too. They have some very colourful language up in Canberra, don't they?
Oh, we certainly do. Are there forms of ritualising anger that dissipates it? That works for society as a whole, public displays.
Well, some people say that it's one of the functions of sport, for example, to ritualize conflict. You have a harmless conflict, but a lot of the same emotions get involved, of excitement and adrenaline and all that. And then people, for some reason, go away feeling better. So it may be that that's the great ritualization of conflict and anger.
I must say I prefer the stand-up comedian.
Yes, I do too.
In fact, Robina, I wonder how much you use humor in your work, because I know that you have done a great deal of work and still do with prisoners in maximum security jail. Is dealing with their anger the most important work that you do?
Not really. I wouldn't say it that way. I think, well, first of all, I'm not trying to be cliched here, but the people we work with in prison are really the same as us. They happen to be living in these ugly houses and they haven't got a key, you know, they can't get out. And I would really also say there are plenty of psychotics in prison, really unhappy people, but there are plenty outside as well. And the ones who come to us, because the Buddhist approach, of course, is you don't try to convert people, that's considered rather bad manners. It's people who want to look at their minds. So the people I deal with are human beings who probably, mostly the working class, mostly suffering, mostly uneducated and who had drugs and violence and gangs in their lives. So there's clearly masses of anger. But the people we deal with are those who want to look at their minds, and anybody who probably, you know, uses Buddhism in their lives is doing that. So humour I think you can only have humour when you don't have much anger, actually. You look at people who are really angry. And the fundamentalists, I'm sorry to say, look pretty angry to me. There's no humour. Yeah. There's not a skerrick of humour. Yeah. But look at the Dalai Lama. I'm not trying to be prejudiced, but he's a very funny guy, you know. He's got a pretty appalling life. He should be out of his brain with anger in normal terms, what's happened to his own country. But he's a very funny person. So I think humour comes when you have less anger and you're able to have more empathy with others.
Mm. Yeah. How do you deal with the anger of the prisoners? What are the ways in which you teach them to deal with their anger?
To know their own minds, in the same way that the tools that I'm using, these fundamental introspective techniques that you use to see yourself very clearly, which is this meaning of meditation, you know, very down to earth, very practical introspection that enables you. And of course, I'm using the Buddhist model of the mind, this understanding of what attachment is, what anger is. So you learn to see your own mind, understand it clearly and where you're coming from and your own neediness and therefore your own impatience. So the more you see that, the more you're able to, basically one way to say what a Buddhist is being a cognitive therapist. You're learning to argue with the neurotic voices inside you. You're using your wisdom voices to argue with the neurotic voices to slowly kind of reprogram your mind. Basically, you're doing that.
Robert, as a psychiatrist, do you ever recommend that anger be managed through drugs?
Oh, certainly when anger is a result of a psychiatric condition. There are certain specified categories. Now, they love shoving terms on them. Impulsive episodic disorder. The old term used to be episodic discontrol. It's all jargon. And there are different ways of doing it, and sometimes you can use medication, but clearly that is either a short-term thing or you're trying to fix an underlying condition, whether it's psychosis or depression or something.
Does it work?
Yes. But you're dealing with so many factors, including motivation and compliance, that it's not always as easy as it sounds. In theory, it works, and it does work in some cases, but it doesn't necessarily last.
What about the person who lives with too little anger?
I can see that as just as big a problem as too much anger. If you really try and say, how does neuroscience see the issue, what you're talking about is conscience or coordinating is now summed up by the term theory of mind. And theory of mind is where it's not just your set of emotions, but it's your ability to read emotions of the people you're dealing with and feed a response back. And some people say that this is the psychological structure that essentially shows our humanity as opposed to everything that came before that was purely primitive.
So, Robina, does the concept of living with too little anger make sense from a Buddhist perspective?
No, I was about to ask you. There seems to be an assumption in there that anger is necessary.
Yes, that was the assumption.
Yes. Well, I would agree with Buddha here and say that that's perhaps not true, and which again gets us really down to our clear understanding of what anger is and what it's not. And I think a kind of a cliched idea of a person who isn't angry is a person who's weak and passive and repressed, is repressing. But I don't think that's so. I think a person who doesn't have anger would be a person who doesn't have ill will, a person who has empathy with others, a person who has compassion, and a person who sees others clearly and has wisdom and can also be very strong and even wrathful if necessary. But in their heart, they are not angry, which means wishing others harm.
So they're not emotionally neutral?
Oh, no way. And I don't want to be, again, I think Dalai Lama is a good example only because lots of people see him and can see very clearly he's not a neutral person. He's funny, he talks, he laughs a lot, he shouts, he's loud. But I would perhaps argue he's not angry, which means for me wanting others to harm, having a strong sense of isolation and not liking that thing in front of you because it's disturbing your peace.
Simon, is there a philosophical equivalent to that? I suppose we get back to Seneca, but...
I'm having a little trouble with understanding exactly what's been hoped for here, because Robina said that it was okay for the Dalai Lama or somebody, the Buddhist saint, as it were, to be wrathful.
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, I thought you did.
No, I beg your pardon, I meant. I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
I beg your pardon.
Well, you know, nobody wants people to pretend to be angry when they're not.
No.
So if there are situations that call for anger, I mean, Dostoevsky gives us one in The Brothers Karamazov, the landowner, one of whose peasants' little boy throws a stone by accident and hits his favourite dog, so he sets the hounds on the little boy. And basically the moral of the story is if you don't get angry at that man, there's something wrong with you. If you're just apathetic about that, you say, oh, well, that's the sort of thing that happens, then there's something wrong with you. It's a case that calls for anger. It calls for a bit of Ezekiel.
What I'm suggesting is that the opposite of not being angry doesn't mean apathy. That's my point.
Right, yes.
That's all. So the person who's worked on their mind and gone beyond ill will and has an empathy with others can also be the mother who says no more chocolate.
Yes.
And you could say she's using anger, but in her heart is not meaning harm to her child.
Right.
So that's what I'm thinking I'm meaning.
But you see, a mother's response, say, to, I mean, suppose the child lies about having taken the last chocolate or something, then you've got to do something to show that this is not on.
But that's my point. You're showing it. Yeah. But her wish is to help the child. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes.
But that's my point. It's where you're coming from. Anger that is angry would be, I want to harm you.
Wanting to destroy.
That's what I'm saying. So you can, in that way you can pretend, but it could be authentic
that's
too.
That's the problem with Ezekiel, I think. He wants to destroy.
You mean he wasn't coming from a good place, this Ezekiel?
Robert, do you have a response to Robina's view?
What I'm thinking about when you ask me about what kind of people could have too little anger, certain situations, which of course would be found in a clinical situation. For example, somebody with social phobia who's terrified of confrontation and therefore will allow themselves to be abused in all kind of ways. Somebody who's terribly depressed, they will just sit there and be very apathetic and often let all sorts of things happen. So it's part of that kind of construct that I'm looking at. But it's certainly not saying you're encouraging people to beat their chests and storm around. In fact, if you look at it from a psychological, not a psychiatric point of view, assertiveness, which is an important thing for many people to improve their confidence. The first thing they tell you at assertiveness classes is this is not shouting people down. This is not beating them down. This is getting your message across in a good and effective way. But to do that, you first need to recognize that something is making you angry or something is wrong.
Robert Kaplan is Clinical Associate Professor at the University of Wollongong's Medical School, and he's talking about anger together with Simon Blackburn, who's Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge, and Robina Corton, who's recorded a CD set called Silent Mind, Dealing with Stress in a Troubled World. Well, if anger has got you going, why not go to Pool and let it all hang out creatively? You can upload your original work of videos, audio and images, but if it's audio, we might feature it in next month's program, which will be on gluttony. For a link to Pool, go to abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Coming up soon, Mandy gets over her bad anger and starts a new life with Jesus. Now, back to Robina Corton, Robert Kaplan and Simon Blackburn on anger. Simon, can I put to you that there might be certain kinds of societies that have better ways of dealing with anger? For example, if one compares a democratic, liberal, open society to, say, a closed, totalitarian or even a utopian experiment.
Well, I think democratic societies are probably rather bad at this because in the cacophony of everybody having their voice expressed, and especially nowadays, unless you shout loudly, you don't get heard. At least many people will perceive it like that. And, of course, the emotion that motivates you to shout the loudest is often anger. So I think it's no accident that, say, city life generates more anger. This is the cliche, but I think it's probably true that city life generates more anger than, say, country life. Because in the rural world, things are slow, your voice is known. You know, if I don't like what you've done, I don't have to actually beat my fists in the air and try and destroy your house and so on.
But Simon, if I can put in here, all the statistics show us that rural life is short, nasty and brutish. They commit suicide more. Violence and abuse is far more than in city life nowadays. So how does that fit in with this Rousseauian view?
Okay, perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps then the cliche is misleading. Yes. But I still think the democratic societies where you have to shout to be heard are not apt to diminish anger.
So what's the alternative? I mean, a more controlled totalitarian society, a utopian experiment with everyone's roles very clearly outlined?
Well, I don't think... Walden too. Yes, or perhaps a monastery. I don't think we have to go as far as utopia. We can educate for harmony and for negotiation and for people to resolve their differences in a civilized way, and often it works.
But in a democratic society, and here I am championing this wonderful experiment that I think yes. still works, we do actually learn to accept and absorb a great deal of difference that we would normally not even, you know, expect to in social situations, oh, yes. which are so multicultural yeah, and yeah. multi-ideological.
Oh, yes. Don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking democracy. I agree with Winston Churchill. It's the worst of all systems of government except for all the others. But I do think that, you know, one of the, as it were, things to watch, if you like, mm-hmm. is the place of anger in such a society. And, of course, you know, democracy, as is often pointed out, does rest on a presupposition that people are willing to accept the ballot, that they are willing to negotiate and to put up with not quite getting what they want, which is in itself a modification of anger.
Mm-hmm. Robina, how about in the monastery? I've spoken to many monks and nuns who've said, oh, it's not as calm, it's not all calm waters. It can be very difficult, very turbulent. How would you see the monastery as a place that deals with anger? Do you think it's better
situated? I have no idea, Rachel. I have lived in monasteries, but I don't like to. I'd prefer to live on my own. I don't know. But I think in general, there's the mind, what's happening inside, which is the motivator, and then there's the behaviour. So here we're talking at the behaviour level most of the time. But it seems to me, whether you're in a democratic society or in a monastery, you have to have these two, but it starts with looking into the mind, because then I can then train my behaviour to be appropriate. So it's got to start inside. But I want to make a comment about depression and guilt. My feeling is, if I look into this state of mind called aversion, which then motivates the fist and the loud voice to show anger, that guilt and depression are these internalized. They're states of aversion. If you look into yourself, you see aversion to something, but your response is an internal one, which then brings depression and hopelessness or fear to speak your mind, you know.
Robert, that brings me to you, because anger, as we've been talking about it, has often been directed outward. But but anger is so often directed inward,
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Well, this is Freud's most famous thing from his paper on mourning and melancholia that showed that depression is simply like a kind of a mourning for an object turned in against yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this has been recognized for 2,000 years. Freud wasn't that original. But certainly, self-destructive behavior is almost intrinsic to human beings. And if you look at the archaeological findings, you know, there's tattoos and all sorts of self-decoration. But in some cases, it goes to self-destructive sort of things.
Do you think anger is the hardest emotion to control, Simon?
Oh, I doubt it. I should have thought fear was at least as hard.
Yes, I agree.
Most people can't do much about the fear of death. And many people can't do much about the fear of snakes or spiders or open spaces or closed spaces. You know, there's all kinds of ways in which fear can grip us. And I think it's probably as hard to eradicate or harder for many people than anger. But I defer to Robert, who's the clinician here. But this will be my snap judgment.
In clinical situations, remember I'm talking about clinical cases, there's no doubt that anger is the hardest.
Uh-huh.
And you can see for the extreme lengths they've gone in psychiatry to the, was it 30 years ago, they were still doing these electrode implants in the amygdala and a desperate attempt to control some people with this. So that's my view. It is the most extreme. But those are a small cluster, not in daily life.
I'd suggest that fear actually is at the basis of all the unhappy emotions, all the uncontrolled emotions, in the sort of primordial sense of this sense of I rising in great panic. And I think anger actually was a response to that. If I look into my own mind, anger in my life was one of my main emotions. And becoming familiar with my own mind a little bit, this panic, if I see the thing that I don't want, it's a panic that arises. So we have this primordial levels of fear, but I think fear is beneath all the unhappy emotions.
I'm not sure I'd... you know, I don't like to speculate about the structure of the emotions because I'm not sure there's any such thing. But I do think that fear and anger, but of course the others are like lust, are pretty...
Yes, on which you've written a lovely book, actually.
Well, they're pretty rebellious sometimes.
Well, then maybe it depends on the person, doesn't it?
Yes.
Some people don't have much of the lust, but have masses of the anger and the other way around.
Yeah, so
we've got to look into our own mind.
But like lust, can I put to you, Simon, that Lust is obviously adaptive for the human race.
Yeah.
It keeps us going.
You wouldn't be here without it.
Isn't anger also adaptive and necessary?
Well, yes, as I've been trying to say, I mean, I'm Aristotelian on this. The mean, it seems to me, I mean, getting to be angry only to the right extent, in the right way, on the right occasion, you know, that's a great goal. And I think similarly to be lustful. It's very interesting that all the seven deadly sins are things which are not in themselves pure black. If you imagine them all eradicated from life, you're imagining apathy, I think. I mean, if somebody doesn't care about other people in a sexual way ever in their lives, or is never angry, is never proud of, for example, doing well at a job, if you're not proud of that, you won't be motivated to do so well. So they all have a proper role. And I'd be interested in a historian of the monastic orders to know why these early guys selected them as the sins. I mean, in my book, cruelty or malevolence is much worse than, say, proper pride, and certainly worse than lust.
Well, proper pride isn't necessarily a deadly sin at all.
No.
The over-exaggerated sense of your own importance that harms others, that's the one that we're talking about, that's a so-called sin, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you can always add the word bad, so it's lust or anger or bad.
And I think we have to sometimes, because we all have different definitions of these.
Sure.
You know? And I would disagree, though, with Simon. I would maybe take Buddha's position here and suggest that this idea that we give equal status to these emotions in us, which is pretty fundamental, I think, in our materialist models of the mind, the Buddha would suggest the ones that are called neurotic, the neurotic eye-based ones, we don't need them, and that the opposite isn't apathy. The opposite is lively and excited and confident and joyful and funny and loving and compassionate. That sounds pretty nice to me.
That sounds lovely to me, but I thought the conquering of desire was the big thing for the Buddha.
And this one of attachment is he has got a structure. He would say that's the basis of all the others. Once that's gone, once the neurotic neediness is gone, anger and pride have no basis.
But I don't like the equation between attachment and neurotic neediness. I mean, I'm
attached. Well, this is my point about good and bad. It's how we define our terms, isn't it, Simon? The word attachment, of course, but the way Buddha's using it is the neurotic one. He only means the negative ones as neurotic, not good. How could you say a good thing is bad?
Well, I'll have to take your word for it. I mean, the kind of popular view of Buddhism is you just sit around going, om, and that's not attachment to anyone.
Well, you certainly cut off your emotional attachments to a lot of things and even views. In fact, I read in the Mandela magazine, the Buddhist magazine, one of the articles was written by someone, a Buddhist, talking about the Middle East conflict, and he was actually advocating a detachment from views. And I thought, how can you actually resolve anything and live in a society if you detach from views?
I don't know who this person is, but I disagree with them. It sounds very weird. Everything is view, actually. We all have a view. It's a question of whether the view is in sync with reality. That's the trick, isn't it?
Well, Robert, what do you do to diffuse your anger?
Oh, think about other things, distract myself.
How do you distract yourself?
Oh, think about pleasant scenes. Actually, in my case, I start going over some writing and I change anger into frustration because I'm never going to finish that piece and I've got to do it in a rush. And it's amazing how it sort of spreads over me.
So is work one of the great antidotes for anger, actually channeling one's anger into something good? Isn't that sublimation?
Well, now Freud used sublimation in a different way. His classic case is somebody who can't deal with latent homosexuality and becomes a Boy Scoutmaster. I just don't even want to take that any further. No, so that's not sublimation. It's distraction, I think, is a better way of putting it.
Distraction. So work is a great distraction for anger, isn't it?
It's one of them. Generally, it's lifestyle issues, and it's also tending to your other emotions. It's interesting how often in clinical practice, people who are depressed don't come in weeping and saying, I'm depressed. They come in with an incident where they've really lost their temper out of character, and it becomes pretty clear why that's happening. So you've got to attend to those things quickly, and then the rest settles into place.
I think, you know, a standard reaction to anger, I think, is to walk away. And basically, that's a good
That's your method, is it, Simon?
Yeah, if I'm getting very angry at, I don't know, the fact that this dumb shopkeeper can't, you know, acknowledge the fact that what he sold me is a bundle of rubbish when I'm trying to point it out to him, then I'll walk out of the shop, you know, count to 10, take a deep breath, and then, of course, as Robert says, go and do some work or something, and you forget all about it.
So is that the best revenge forgetting all about it.
Well, of course, the best revenge on somebody who's getting angry with you is contempt. I mean, if you really want to make somebody angry, just show you don't care whether they're angry. That really is a killer. But, of course, that's the way people kill each other outside pubs that's on right. Saturday night.
Exactly. Well, that's right. Dylan Thomas raging yes. against the dying of the light. yes.
Robina, have you been in a situation where anger has got the better of you?
Oh, I spent my life being angry. Absolutely. Delightedly, joyfully, thinking I was the smartest person around, yes.
Then what? I mean,
well, then I'm learning to see, you know. I happen to be using Buddha's tools in my life. I'm not trying to own all this as my own, so I'm giving his due here. But I find it quite useful, and that means seeing my mind clearly, unravelling these emotions, understanding that, and this is the Buddhist approach, that they're conceptually based. There are these little viewpoints, there's stories in there that I happen to be quite familiar with. So when unravelling them and becoming familiar and literally changing them, so I can say over these years I have become less angry, not suppressing it, but restructuring my way of seeing things. So the things that would make me annoyed once literally do not now.
Mm-hmm. Robert mentioned the neurological basis of lots of this, and I think a lot of men certainly find that they get less angry, less quick to anger, as the, presumably, the testosterone levels start to decrease. And
well, I like the point of view of psychopaths, and I'm talking about real psychopaths. Yes. Now, this is a well-known fact. They seem to burn out after the age of 40. Now, nobody's really discovered this, but it seems
makes
to
sense,
be almost a neurological or brain maturing that they get to it.
That's
testosterone isn't the only thing.
No, it's not.
At one stage, there was the famous triple Y condition. They found a number of people in prison with violent offences had double or triple Y male chromosomes. They got very excited, were these super males. It hasn't panned out, but certainly there's something in that.
You know, these marvelous experiments they've been doing on these Tibetan. Have you been, you know, much of that, Robert?
No,
reading of that
at
experiment. Mindandlife.org, you should check it out. There's some marvelous experiments on the brains of people who have learned to do to meditate, to do compassion meditations or whatever. There's a lot of experiments.
The neurophysiology meditation.
Precisely,
as well.
Yes. So we can see there that the physical condition is a huge one, but with mental work, we can even change the physical condition.
I love the example that London taxi drivers have expanded hippocampi, which is the
Do they?
It's the neurological seat of memory.
Yes, from this business of the
knowledge. Of the knowledge.
So just as taxi drivers can learn to remember the streets of London, I suppose we can learn to control our anger
through understanding fundamentally
how it works.
We look at anger, in my particular interest, which is not psychiatry, but in doctors and patients, and how often patients come in with anger, and of course how often doctors cope very poorly. And one of the most interesting examples, if you look at Jesus' work as a healer, after all, this is what made him famous. And I think there are 33 cases listed in the four Gospels of his healing. Now, he was interesting. He was not a hands-on healer. He was a talking healer. He would command the spirit to leave. But in one case, he lost his temper, and I think he smote someone on the forehead eventually in frustration to get the spirit to go. And I think that's a nice example of the fact that being a shaman, a healer, a prophet, or a doctor brings in frustrations with your target audience that occasionally can get to you. In fact, more than occasionally.
Sure it can, yes.
It certainly can. Yes. I mean, I think, as you say, not many people recognize how much anger is actually simmering between the doctor and patient. Well, from Jesus smiting demons or casting them out to neurology, philosophy, and Buddhism. It's been, I think, a wonderful discussion on anger. I'm not sure how far we've resolved the issue, but I think we all know.
None of us got angry.
None of us
got
angry. However, I think a bit of frustration, because it is such a large topic and one that is an abiding one, obviously, one we'll be with for the rest of our lives.
Right. Well, as Martin Luther King said, it's okay to be angry, but then you say, what can I do about it?
Yeah.
Rather than just simmering, you go out and act and try to change things.
And I think Psalm 4 says, be angry, but don't sin.
There you go, that's nice.
Robina Corton, Simon Blackburn, Robert Kaplan, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Well, I think we did the rounds of the kitchen on anger and still left a lot to think about. Philosopher Simon Blackburn is the author of Being Good, An Introduction to Ethics. Forensic psychiatrist Robert Kaplan is the author of Medical Murder, Disturbing Cases of Doctors Who Kill. And the Venerable Robina Corton is a Buddhist nun who's involved in the Liberation Prison Project. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, and we're talking about anger. No group epitomized the angry generation more than the who were famous for smashing their instruments on stage. People try to put us to death. Talking about my generation. Just because we get around. Talking about my generation. They say do look awful. Talking about my generation. Hope I die before I get old. The unmistakable angry rock group, The Who. Every day while you're methodically going about your life, there are others whose lives are in a spin, downward, and as things get more out of control, they get angrier and look for escape. But the usual means only make things worse. That's Mandy's story, until she found a way out.
Hello, my name is Mandy, and I'm 35 years old, and I'd like to share how my life of bad anger has dramatically changed. Before I do, I'd like to share my background and heart. I was brought up in a home that was a little dysfunctional. My mum and dad constantly fought, and I always had a deep longing inside to feel accepted and loved. Loving words and emotions weren't a thing that were expressed, and I always had a sense of feeling that I wanted to know who I was, but I didn't have any real idea. When my parents used to fight, it was aggressive and I used to hide and just wanted it all to end. Just before my parents divorced at the age of 10 years old, I was told that I wasn't their real child. I felt like I had lived a life that was a lie and it wasn't real. Now looking back, I can see that is where deep roots of rejection and abandonment set in. I ended up living with my mum and I had a lot of hurt and anger and shame built up. The only way I probably knew how to express it was through rebellion. I thought I was taking a stand as a child, crying out for attention. Can't you hear my pain? I was hurt, and the only way that it seemed to come out was through the emotion I recognised best through early childhood, and that was anger, which I see now as a cover-up of pain. I started hanging around other young people that were from single-parent families. The children were also doing as they pleased. This went on into my high school years, the small amount of time I was at school. In anger and rage, I remember running away from home at 10 years old. I so much wanted my dad and mum to look for me some sort of way to know they cared, but they never did. I ended up in a girls' home called Manali. They said I was uncontrollable, so I ran away and they took me straight back. I couldn't live with my dad. He was living a new life with his girlfriend. The pain and anger kept building up inside. I went back to my mum's and then off again to another foster home. This happened on many occasions. I longed to have a stable home and also to be loved and wanted. I started to smoke at the age of 12 years old, along with drinking alcohol, and at 13 years of age, I smoked pot. I wanted to escape the hurt, rejection, and anger I carried. When I was out of reality, things seemed a little better. I started to date guys that were older than me. Once again, trying to numb my pain, it felt good to have someone pay attention to me and tell me they loved me. When I look back now, all of my relationships were ones of abuse. I abused them emotionally. I would go into fits of rage and jealousy, and they would also. I have been in relationships where I would get belted and stayed in them, as it was normal to me growing up in a family that abused each other, not physically, but verbally and emotionally. I believe they're the scars that stay around longer. At 15 years old, I had my first child. I was a baby having a baby. I wanted to have the baby so I could love someone and they would love me back. I longed to have a pretty picture of a family. I had no idea of what real love was or how to give it to my son. At the age of 17, I started to use heroin. I ended up in jail at the age of 18 years old for something minor. By the age of 22 years old, I was about to have my second child. I had a raging heroin habit and the doctor said if I didn't go to a detox and stabilization unit, they would take the baby through docs. I began the methadone program, but some more poor choices in relationships, and my price was to spend another 3 years in prison due to being involved with a robbery that went wrong and caused an innocent person to lose their life. My children were with my mum. She always watched them. As I mentioned before, I wasn't a mum of love and responsibility, and as a person in addiction, expressing my anger in a destructive way. Today, my life is so different, and I'll tell you why. If you can hear my heart and what I was sharing, I was a child desperate for love. I expressed anger as I didn't know how to put into words of how hurt I was. When I was in jail a few times, I was drawn to pick up the Bible and read it. I had no understanding of it whatsoever. I would go to the chapel service to just hang with other women, to mess around and have something to do. I enjoyed singing the songs and the Bible would be read out. The rest of the week, I would be getting into drugs and trying to find things to do to make me laugh as much as possible. My friends in there were the same. I had three other opportunities of getting out. No sooner was I out, I was back in. The second time I was in prison, I used to see this lady. She seemed so different. I didn't know what it was. She looked like she glowed. I was drawn to her. She ended up sharing her faith and asked me if I wanted to go to prison fellowship with her. I said yes. Our friendship began to grow. I remember a band came into the jail called Sold Out. When they began to play the music and sing, I began to cry like I never had before. I thank God that my friend was next to me. We continued to go to prison fellowship, where friendships began to be built. At night, I would read the Bible still with little understanding. I asked my friend lots of questions. She never grew tired of them. She ended up getting out. I was really sad. Then I got out. I had a few Christian people in my life. I knew I wanted to go to church. I went to a few but felt way out of place. My loneliness and anger caused me to call my ex, and that's where all the pain and misery started to come back into both of our lives. I have now learnt two hurting, angry people don't make one whole. Here I was reliving the same life of addiction, anger and pain. I had also breached my parole and was going back to court. My son was in a church at the time. I rang his youth leader crying, asking him to be there for my son. I was going back to jail. I believe many people were praying for me, and that's when I had a divine intervention from God. I was walking through Parramatta Mall thinking my life is an utter mess. I bumped into another addict I knew. He said if I wanted to get things together, I should meet some people he knew. As he was saying this, he turned me around and these men were behind me. All I could catch in the conversation was, "We have Christian recovery homes for 12 months. All I knew was I was sick and tired, and they took me to the women's home. Going through the women's home has absolutely changed my life. I'm not saying that I'm perfect or have it all together. Yes, I have made many mistakes. But one thing I know is that Jesus never gave up on me or quit on me when others did. He has never left me or let me down. He's faithful, loving and compassionate. He's gentle and not forceful. He has filled my heart and mind with peace, contentment and joy. That is replacing the abusive expressions of my anger. I have an identity today. I'm a child of God with a purpose and destiny. Jesus has given me hope and he has given me self-worth. I can hold my head high knowing that he has clothed me with strength and dignity. My value today is not in what someone else says. My value is in who Jesus says I am. I praise Jesus today that I'm able to say I am a woman of vision. I have a heart to reach out to other women and to let them know there is a way out of the trap they may be in. Today, because of getting to know who Jesus is and being in a relationship with him and with the support of prison fellowship and my church family, I have gained control over my abusive anger and the way I express myself. Love from a child of God that once was lost in anger and brokenness, who is now truly free.
The power of faith. And Mandy is putting all her experience to good use and is studying to be a drug and alcohol counsellor in New South Wales. Good on you, Mandy. And thanks to Prison Fellowship for their help.
The storm is passing over. The storm is passing over. The storm is passing over. Alleluia.
That's our program on anger. You can hear it again by going to our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings, where you can also read a transcript later in the week or download the audio. It was produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Jenny Parsonage. It's 100 years since the death of Mary MacKillop, who's in line to be Australia's first saint. Next week, we hear about a play on her life that's touring Australia. and I'll be giving the inaugural Mary MacKillop Lecture in Brisbane, August 5th, at the Corpus Christi College Cultural Centre in Nunda at 7 p.m. So if you're in Brisbane, do please join me. I'd love to see you there. Details will be on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Till next week, so long from me, Rachel Conn.
The storm is passing over. Hallelujah.
Death was one of those things you could rely upon, like taxes. But death is changing, or at least the way we relate to it certainly is. Death in the 21st century is a very visual experience. But for some, it's a visibility that often lacks intimacy. So from online memorials to mass public grieving, find out more on Future Tense. And you can download or stream the program from the Radio National website.